You're listening to the River East Church Podcast, a Jesus community for the world.
You may have noticed that we have been using the lines of this sung refrain as the titles of our sermons for this series. And today, may we taste your peace. That title makes me curious. What does peace taste like? It's actually easier to describe the taste of fear. Anxiety reduces the flow of saliva in our mouth, which can leave a bitter taste. A sudden change of adrenaline can produce a metallic or copper taste. And intense stress can trigger acid reflux, giving us an acidic taste in our mouth. In any of its forms, fear tastes terrible. And we typically do what we can to avoid the taste of fear. Recently, a number of people have mentioned to me that for their own peace of mind, they have reduced their consumption of the news recently. The pain in the news increases our own anxiety. And reports of decisions made, and then unmade, and then remade, well, that's just crazy making. And so some of us are limiting the number or the amount of news that we consume. On the other hand, some of us are responding to the changes in the world scene by becoming watchdogs, doing more political analysis rather than less. Isaiah also experienced major destabilization living in Jerusalem, the capital city of Judah, 700 years before Christ. And of these two postures, distancing or leaning in, Isaiah definitely takes the second approach. If Isaiah were alive today, he'd be a well-known political commentator. Maybe even a panelist on CBC's At Issue with Rosemary Barton. And if he were here, he'd be breaking down the biggest political stories of our time, offering context, debate, and predictions. Or if he had been alive over the last 5 years, his public disagreement with King Ahaz might be compared to the actions of Jody Wilson-Raybould, or Jane Philpott, or Chrystia Freeland. Just like these three who publicly challenged Canada's prime minister in the last several years, Isaiah publicly challenges the national leadership of his day. And just like these three, Isaiah prioritizes principle over unity with those in power. And Isaiah's principles contain three core convictions. First, God is the great ruler of heaven and earth. In Isaiah's inaugural vision, he sees God high and lifted up, sitting on a throne. And that vision colors Isaiah's attitude toward all rivals for allegiance that rightly belongs to God. Secondly, Isaiah believes that Jerusalem is the city where God chooses to live, and so God will ultimately save Jerusalem. However, holy God will not live in a moral slum. And that means that ethically corrupt Jerusalem must be purified before the city will be saved, purified by judgment. And so Isaiah is driven, like absolutely driven, to warn the people, to tell them what's wrong with them and what's wrong with their city. And there is a lot of judgment in Isaiah's writing. And then thirdly, Isaiah trusts God's promise that there will always be a king from David's family on the throne. And these three principles are what motivates Isaiah's word of hope that Julie just shared with us. And thank you, Julie. In previous chapters, Isaiah is in conversation with King Ahaz of Judah, who is feeling the squeeze of neighboring countries. And that threat is far more intense than the occasional comments about becoming the 51st state. Assyria is on the move, sweeping across the land, taking one nation after another. And Assyria is a fighting machine. They have the first ever standing professional army paid by the state to fight year-round. And they can outlast all other armies because the other countries conscript peasant farmers as warriors. And so in seeding time and harvest time, everyone just lays down their weapons and goes home to do their real work. Assyria is also the first to use iron weaponry, and they have developed an infrastructure to transport large weapons over long distances. So now Assyria can outweigh and outfight any nation defended by fighting farmers. And to complicate the situation, Israel, which is Judah's sister nation, Israel makes an alliance with their neighbor Syria, sometimes called Aram. And this alliance is to fight Assyria. And these two nations propose to King Ahaz that Judah join them. Besides, they say, if Ahaz won't join the alliance, then they'll gang up and they'll attack Judah and they'll depose Ahaz and they'll put a puppet king on the throne, and then the three nations will still unite to fend off the terrible Assyria. Ahaz and the whole nation taste fear as their hearts shake from the threat from nearby Israel and Aram. But not Isaiah. In the face of peril, Isaiah tastes peace. He reminds me a little bit of Olga Rubel from Ukraine, who shared here in this pulpit on Thanksgiving Sunday. And she was returning to Zaporizhia the very next week. And she let us know she didn't even know if her house would be standing. Bombs fall around her every day. And she said, she has chosen not to be afraid. God is in control. Isaiah, too, believes that God is in control. And motivated by his three core convictions, Isaiah announces in today's Bible passage that God will lift the threat of Israel and Syria as on the day of Midian. Back in the day, when the Midianites were attacking, timid Gideon raised an army of 300. And at night, they surrounded the vast encampment of the Midianites and caused panic using only trumpets and raised torches. This is the same God who is working with us today, Isaiah says. And in the face of overwhelming odds, it is God who will do the fighting. Like in the vision of beating swords into plowshares, with the taste of peace on his tongue, Isaiah describes in the passage that Julie just recited for us, Isaiah describes how the fighting gear, the trampling boots and the bloody uniforms will be used as fuel for the cook stove. And then he gives the encouragement that Handel's Messiah makes so familiar. Julie?
A son is given unto us, a son is given.
Thanks, Julie. Who's that son? The big news is that King Ahaz has a son, Hezekiah. And Judah's authority will rest on the shoulders of this descendant of David, not on a puppet king imposed by other nations. The words that Julie just sang are either a birth announcement for baby Hezekiah, or probably a coronation ceremony for Hezekiah, where names and blessing are bestowed on the new king. Wonderful counselor, a ruler with wisdom and discernment, mighty God, a king with power who governs according to God's vision for healing, forgiveness, restoration, and well-being. Eternal Father, a monarch who does fatherly deeds like caring for the poor and needy and standing for justice. Prince of Peace, creating social order and rest from enemies. And for that moment, the political reality of peace matches Isaiah's grand vision of peace. Judah does not join the alliance. When Assyria does invade Israel and deport its citizens off into exile, Assyria leaves Judah alone. And Judah's new king, Hezekiah, makes some great reforms, although he too has feet of clay. The story continues, as all stories must. 150 years after Isaiah dies, the nation of Judah is also deported, and this time by Babylon. But even in exile, Isaiah's taste of peace lingers. So just a few verses before the passage we heard today, we read how Isaiah passes his teaching on to his disciples, and they continue to treasure these writings down through the generations. And years later, in Babylon, in exile, new students study Isaiah's convictions, and they are inspired by Isaiah's unshakable trust in God, the ruler of heaven and earth. And claiming Isaiah's trust in God for themselves, they also deconstruct some of his convictions. For example, there no longer is a descendant of David on Judah's throne because, well, there's no throne anymore. In their deconstruction, they could have discarded Isaiah's teaching completely. Instead, they include it and they transcend it. They trace the history and reconstruct an updated interpretation of Isaiah's vision for their own time. They translate Isaiah's words of harsh judgment into judgment completed, and into forgiveness. And even in exile, they taste peace for themselves. They connect the dots between their current politics and Isaiah's vision of redemption, and they discern that Cyrus, a Persian king, is a new hope to allow the exiles to return to their homes as free people, and there to finally usher in that promised endless peace. In this way, an unnamed writer in exile takes pen to paper, or probably ink to scroll, and builds on the original harsh words of Isaiah with words of forgiveness and words of hope and words of grief. This author, whom we often call Second Isaiah, is primarily the author of chapters 40 to 55, where we find the often repeated sentence structure, "At an earlier time, this happened, but later, this happened." And that's a sentence structure that's in the passage that we have this morning as well. It is likely that 2 Isaiah inserts his anticipatory taste of peace into earlier chapters that we often refer to as First Isaiah. And the story continues, as all stories must. And miraculously, the exiles do return home to Judah, singing with great anticipation. However, once home, God's glorious reign of endless peace does not materialize like they anticipate. They are returning to the old country of their ancestors, and they're returning more like refugees. And life is hard, and no one describes it as endless peace. And again, instead of rejecting the convictions of 1st and 2nd Isaiah when it doesn't turn out exactly like they expected, they include those convictions and transcend them. And along comes another unknown author, whom we now refer to as 3rd Isaiah. And encouraged and inspired by the faith of 1st and 2nd Isaiah, 3rd Isaiah personally claims that same trust in God, even as 3rd Isaiah also deconstructs some of those previous convictions. In this deconstruction, 3rd Isaiah could have discarded the teachings of the previous Isaiahs. Instead, 3rd Isaiah includes it and transcends it, reconstructing an updated interpretation of Isaiah's vision for his own time. If 1st Isaiah is about loss, and 2nd Isaiah is about grief, 3rd Isaiah is about hope, but only hope that can happen after grief is articulated. The story continues, as all stories must. And today, we are invited into this age-old pattern of faith in God as people of the Word. We read the Bible. We reaffirm trust in God. We deconstruct some parts, and we reconstruct interpretation for our own time. And God invites us to taste the peace of God's vision for the future. With Isaiah 9, we reaffirm that God takes seriously the fear of our day and also the politics of our day. And to face these, God helps us both include and transcend the faith of our ancestors. And even when we don't get it perfectly, God still uses our words and our actions to represent and enact God's commitment to recreating endless peace. And after Christmas, we will marinate in the New Testament stories of this promised Messiah who has already come and who is still coming again to complete the reign of endless peace with justice and with righteousness for this time and for 1,000 years and forevermore. Oh God, hear our prayer. May we taste your peace. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the River East Church podcast, the Jesus Community for the World. We are an Anabaptist church pursuing wisdom, prophecy, and compassion here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can find us online at rivereastchurch.ca. We hope you join us for next time, and until then, may grace and peace be with you.